Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. My name is Edgar Lujano, filling in for Cy Kellett. This second hour, we jump into an Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. You know Jimmy Akin, of course, from Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Jimmy, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. How about you, Edgar?
Living the dream in California. Although I'm realizing that air conditioning isn't a very common thing in Southern California, even when it gets a little warm.
Well, it's a little warm a lot of places right now.
That's true, yeah. I grew up in the Central Valley, so it gets a lot warmer than it does in San Diego, that's for sure. All right. Mm-hmm. It is a Friday. That means a new Mysterious World just dropped. Care to share a little bit about it?
Yeah, so this I've been doing a number of episodes lately on death-related experiences, so like near-death experiences, after-death communications, and this Friday I did one on an experience that terminal lucidity is another one. I did an episode on another experience that occurs just before death with some folks, and that is deathbed visions. They're all throughout history. Have been reports of people having visions on their deathbeds, and this has been talked about for centuries. In fact, if you look in Pope St. Gregory the Great's dialogues from back, he wrote around the year 600, he talks about them. And recently there's been scientific study done of them, and so I took a look at one of the first books, a couple of early one was a chapter in a book, and another was one of the first books that was written about them, and described the types of experiences that occur. People, frequently their pain shuts off if they're having a painful death. The pain goes away, and they frequently will perceive either a barrier between this life and the next, or they'll see the two kind of integrated. They'll see light, they'll feel joy and happiness, and either angels or departed loved ones will come to help them transition into the afterlife. That's what they report. And so, of course, there's a question about how accurate all this is. But the evidence is actually pretty good, because some of these experiences are what are known as peak in Darien experiences. Mm-hmm. I won't go into what that name means unless a caller wants to call and ask, but effectively a peak in Darien experience is one where you see someone in the afterlife that you did not previously know was dead, and it turns out you're right. So for example, one of the peak in Darien experiences I cover was of a British woman a little more than 100 years ago who was dying, and she had just given birth, and unfortunately at the time their women sometimes died after they gave birth, and she sees her father coming to greet her in the afterlife, and then she says, oh, and here's my sister Vida too. Well, it turns out Vida had died like 2 weeks earlier. And this woman was in such frail health that the hospital had advised them to keep the knowledge of Vida's death from her. And so nobody had mentioned it. And her husband was even screening her mail to make sure nobody mentioned Vida had died. And so she had no natural way of knowing her sister Vida was dead. And then Vida shows up in the afterlife to welcome her.
Wow. Fascinating. Yeah. All right. Great. Well, if people want to listen to it, where can they find it?
Well, they can go to my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/Jimmy Akin, or they can go to mysterious.fm.
All right. There it is. If you have a question for Jimmy today, you can reach us at 888-318-7884. That's 888-31-TRUTH to ask Jimmy a question. And now, I kind of want to explore that a little bit more. So my grandmother was telling me that many years ago, after my grandfather passed away, one of my cousins was visiting, and he was, I think, five or younger. And mm-hmm. he just started saying, oh, there's grandpa standing in the mm-hmm. corner of the room. Mm-hmm. And I've heard a lot of stories of children being able to see things like that. And I've heard a few others. Have you had a chance to explore anything in regards to that?
Oh yeah, I did two episodes on that phenomenon. That one occurs after death, and mm-hmm. so these are known as after death communications. And just spontaneously, between 40% and 50% of the population reports an after death communication at least once in their life. It typically is a loved one, and children do sometimes see them, but it's not at all limited to children. And sometimes you have co-witnessed after-death communications. In one of the episodes I did, I give bunches of anecdotes of these things that I take from academic publications. But in one of them, a woman who had just lost her husband went upstairs. Her husband had been very close to his two sons, and one of them was having problems after his dad died. She goes upstairs and sees her deceased husband sitting on the bed with his younger son, explaining to him what has happened to help the son move on. And then they lock eyes, and the deceased husband kind of waves her off, you know, don't disturb us right now. And so she goes back downstairs, and later the son confirmed, yeah, dad appeared, and he told me all about he's doing okay, and I shouldn't grieve him and things like that.
Wow. Okay. Well, I'm going to have to go dig that one out to see if I can take a listen one of these days. Well, thank you so much for informing me that you have an episode on that. I hadn't run into it. So thanks, Jamie.
Yeah. All right. Episodes on that.
Perfect. Well, there we go. I have my whole weekend filled up there. Well, part of my weekend filled up. All right. Shall we go to calls, Jimmy?
Sure.
All right. Let's jump right in talking to Misty in Kentucky, listening on YouTube. Misty, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Go right ahead.
My question is about young Earth. First, I'm a new Christian, and I joined the church at Easter, and I've been trying to reconcile how we can have dinosaur fossils dated back millions and billions of years, but the
millions
Earth is only
anyway.
About Yeah. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I'm really hopelessly confused, and everything I find online just gets me even more confused. I was just wondering if you could point me in the right direction to understand creationism and how the world can be so young.
Okay. Well, there are different theories about creationism. At one end, you have what's known as young Earth creationism, which holds that the world is only a few thousand years old. And then at the other end, you have old Earth creationism that holds that the world is a few billion years old. And young Earth creationists have arguments for their position. Old Earth creationists have arguments for their position, and both of them are compatible with the Christian faith. Being a Christian or a Catholic, you don't have to choose between them. In fact, you're welcome to remain agnostic on the issue of how old the Earth is. So it's not like you have to sort this out. But if you do, those are the two major schools, young Earth creationism and old Earth creationism. I defend the rights of everybody to advocate for their position and make whatever arguments they can. Personally, I think that the evidence supports old Earth creationism. And so I think that we have pretty good evidence the Earth is billions of years old. And that explains why it can have dinosaur fossils that are millions of years old on it, because it's older than the dinosaurs. In terms of how we then read Genesis, I take the position that is mentioned in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, which is that the 6 days of creation in Genesis symbolically represent the work of the Creator. So they're not meant to be a literal chronology. They are a symbol that uses the framework of the Hebrew week to structure and present the work of the Creator. And it doesn't tell us anything about how long it took. It's just, here's God made, you know, the day and the night. He made, you know, the sky and the sea. He made the dry land. He made the sun, moon, and the stars. He made the birds and the fish. He made the land animals and man. He did all that stuff. He made all that stuff. And that's really what Genesis 1 is trying to tell us. And I think there's even a clue in the text a couple of clues that tell us this is a symbolic presentation rather than a literal one. One of the clues, and this is not the big one, One of the clues is that on the first day, so we're told the earth is formless and void, or formless and empty. And on the first 3 days of creation, God solves the formlessness problem by separating things. So he gives the world structure. So on day one, he separates the night from the darkness. On day two, he separates the waters above from the waters below so that we have the sky and the sea. And then on day three, he separates the waters below from each other so that the dry land appears. Then on the next 3 days, so he solved the formlessness problem now. Now he's going to tackle the emptiness problem. So he goes over the same three realms in the same order and populates them. On day four, he populates the day and the night with the sun, moon, and stars. On day five, he populates the sky and the sea with the birds and the fish. And on day six, he populates the land with the land, animals, and man. Okay, so that's one clue that we're looking at a literary structure here, but here's the big one. Day and night existed on day one, but the sun doesn't exist until day four. And the ancients knew as well as we do that it's the sun that causes it to be day and the absence of the sun that causes it to be night. So that's a clue that this is meant to be a literary account, not a literal account. If you're interested in following this up, including where I look at arguments for young earth creationism, I actually did three episodes of Mysterious World on it. It's the only time I've ever done that. It's episodes 119, 120, and 121. And you can find them by going to mysterious.fm/119. mysterious.fm/120 and mysterious.fm/121.
All right, Misty, thank you so much. We're going to go ahead and leave it right there. Also, since you just came into the church, we want to go ahead and give you a free book, Why We're Catholic by Trent Horton. Hopefully, it'll give you a little survey of the general ideas of what Catholics believe to hopefully strengthen you in the Catholic faith. So hang on the line, and Thomas will get your information to send that book out to you. And with that, we're going to go ahead and take our first break, and we will be right back right after this.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at magnificat.com.
Hi, this is Father Mike Schmitz. Please join me for Ascension's Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year here on EWTN Radio. We're going through the entire Bible and the Catechism in 365 days. If you've ever wanted to understand what it means to be Catholic and allow those truths to shape your life, this is for you.
Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year with Father Mike Schmitz. Tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Edgar Vahana, once again filling in for Cy Kellett. This second hour, we're talking to Jimmy Akin. You can ask him anything. You can reach us at 888-318-7884. And with that, we go to Mark in Spokane, Washington. Go right ahead, Mark. Welcome to the show.
It's actually Spokane. I know everybody pronounces that with a wrong A. Okay. In the Bible, for the mustard seed parable, It seems to me that could be taken as either a weed, because it is a weed here, and or it could be a crop, but I don't know of anything that says that they planted mustard back then. Either way, it satisfies the parable, because a weed is hard to control and it spreads all over. So can you answer that?
Mustard, the kind they have in the old world, is, you know, kind of the most prominent species of it is Brassica nigra, or black mustard. And Brassica nigra has been used as a condiment, a spice, for thousands of years all over the ancient world. It was used in Egypt and India and China and places like that, because apparently pretty early on people figured out you can mash up those little seeds and have a really tasty spice that you could put on your cheeseburger, if only they had cheeseburgers back then. It's been in use for a long period of time. Now, it definitely grows wild, which is how humans got it in the first place. They found it growing wild, and then they decided to cultivate it. But actually, in the Gospels, I'd have to look to see which specific Gospel it is, because the parable of the mustard seed appears in more than one of the Gospels. But Jesus actually says it's the smallest of the seeds you plant. And so not only do we know that it was being used as a condiment in the ancient world, we know that in Judea specifically, it was cultivated, that people were planting it and deliberately raising it so that they could have nice, tasty mustard to put on their cheeseburgers that would be developed 2,000 years later, except by that point, a rabbinic tradition arose that you can't put mix dairy and meat products, so you can't actually have a cheeseburger in Judaism today. You can have a regular hamburger, but not a cheeseburger. And if you're going to skip the cheese, you probably want some mustard.
How's that, Mark?
Okay. I heard this from a Protestant minister, and she also said that she compared yeast. The yeast was not in favor with the Jewish people either because of the Passover. In fact, Jesus used unleavened bread at the Last Supper.
He would have used unleavened bread at the Last Supper because it was part of the days of unleavened bread. There were 8 days a year where, beginning with Passover, where you weren't supposed to use leaven or even have it in your house. And so that's when Passover was. So he would have used unleavened bread at that time. But they did use leaven the rest of the year. It was just during this special time that they didn't use leaven because it was in commemoration of the Exodus. And when you use leaven, you have to wait for the leaven to consume some of the sugars in the flour so that it puffs up the flour. And that takes time. You have to let the bread rise. And since they were leaving Egypt in a hurry, they didn't wait for the bread to rise. And so they made unleavened bread for the Exodus specifically. And since Passover commemorates the Exodus, they also they didn't use leaven during that period because of the haste in which they had left Egypt. So, during that period, they wouldn't have had hamburger buns. They could have had, you know, unleavened hamburger pitas, but not hamburger buns. And, you know, as I mentioned later on, there was this no cheese with the meat rule. And of course, bacon cheeseburgers are right out for observant Jewish people. They're really tasty.
Yes, yes, they are. Thanks for your question, Mark. Really appreciate the call. You know, Jimmy, a lot of times when I sit down in front of a cheeseburger, I always thank God for just lifting those food laws, because I wouldn't be able to do it. That cheese is just too tasty on a burger.
Well, you're Filipino. I mean, your family, I'm sorry, is from...
Mexico.
Yes. I'm sorry. I had that.
It's not the first time I've heard that. Filipino's a common thing.
it was a brain slip. I caught myself in the middle of making it. But here's the thing. You don't have Jewish ancestry in all likelihood. And if you don't have Jewish ancestry, you were never under those laws. They were binding only on the Jewish people ever. And they ceased to be binding on the Jewish people at the time of Christ.
That's right. I love it. Perfect. And today is the day of being mistaken for different cultures. Today I was called Chaldean twice. So there's that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. At my boxing class this morning. So there we have it. Filipino and Chaldean all in one day. So
there you are.
All right. And so with that, we move on to Patricia in Pennsylvania, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Patricia, thank you so much for downloading the app, and go right ahead with your question.
Thank you so much. I love this opportunity to learn from you guys. As a total aside, Jimmy, I wonder if you recognize your dropping your G's now that you've gone to your home state. There's a change in your diction, and I love it. I do not mean this as derogatory in any way. I love accents.
Thank you.
Could you please put some parameters about Jesus' soul? I had occasion to come across a prayer, which is, I believe, Anime Christi. And the first line is, Jesus' soul. And it never occurred to me that perhaps Jesus had a soul just like mine. And I'm in a grieving process, so I'm learning through that. It's not a loss, it's a gain, because my faith is being increased through it. So I'll stop talking, but if you could please enlighten me a bit about Jesus' soul. Thank you.
Okay, so you've been reading the Anima Christi prayer. Anima is the Latin word for soul, and Christi is the possessive form of Christ. So Anima Christi means soul of Christ. And he had a soul because he had a human nature, and human nature includes a soul. Humans have a nature that gives us a physical body and a soul. And since he took on a human nature, he took on all of the human nature. So that includes the soul. So in addition to his divine nature, Christ also has a human soul and a human body. And that has led some people to have a special devotion to Christ's human soul so that we don't forget about it. You know, some people, there actually was a heresy in the early church that held that Christ didn't have a soul, that his divinity took the place of his soul. And so he was, to put it in kind of modern vernacular, he was just God in a bod. You know, he had his divine nature and a body, but no human soul. And that's a heresy. He took on a full human nature, and thus he had a human soul just like ours. Now, his soul was perfect because, of course, everything about Jesus is perfect. And the will in his human soul was perfectly united with the will in his divine nature, so there was never a conflict between them. But he had a human soul because he took on a human nature. And so everything that we have, barring sin, he also had.
Lovely.
Does that help?
Yes, it does. Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Patricia.
No problem.
Thank you for your call, Patricia.
And very sorry to hear about your grieving process. We'll encourage the listeners to pray for you and for all that are affected by the situation.
Yeah, thank you so much, Patricia, for your calling. Yes, like Jimmy said, everyone, if you can, please pray for Patricia and her loved ones. All right, and with that, we go over to an anonymous caller listening on Catholic.com. Go right ahead with your question.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you loud and clear.
What's your question?
Okay, so I'm having problems with two different dioceses that are kind of near each other in two different cities where I live. I want to know, how can I appeal to a higher authority above the diocese? I've heard of, like, appealing to the Apostolic Nuncio or something like that, maybe the USCCB bishops. Like, I'm being restricted in these dioceses from doing pretty much anything ministry-related. One of the dioceses I live is trying to help me, but it's going very slow. I don't trust these people. The thing is, like, I have autism. Like, I'm neurodivergent, and people keep complaining that, like, I offend people, especially like women. Like a lot of my I have lack of boundary. Like nobody's really, like, none of my accusers are coming forward. I'm not able to, like, face my accusers and defend myself. Mm-hmm. Instead, I'm just being, like, flagged. My name's being flagged in the system. You know, I'm 37. Like, if I ever, you know, this is, like, ruining my chances of meeting a nice young lady. Like, I want to get married. Like. Mm-hmm. This is going to, like, spread. Before you know it, it's going to be every diocese in the whole state. Like, it's just ridiculous. Like, I don't.
Okay, Anonymous, let me ask.
And how to deal with, like, neurodivergent people.
Okay, let me ask you a question, Anonymous. You said you're being restricted from anything having to do with ministry. I just want to verify, you are not ordained. Is that correct? You're not a deacon.
No, I'm a lay person.
Okay. So these are lay ministries that you're talking about. Okay.
Yeah, maybe young adults. Like, it's mainly the young people, but I noticed that pretty much a lot of Catholics from a lot of different ages are I don't know where the, I don't know who's complaining. All I know is that I'm being told that various people are complaining. Oh, this has been happening for like 3-4 years, and particularly after COVID.
I understand your situation, and I want to give you the best answer I can. I'm afraid we're going to hit the break, and it's a hard break in a minute or so, so I'll probably need to continue this on the other side of the break. In terms of who you can appeal to, well, hypothetically, if you want to appeal above a bishop's head, you could appeal to the archdiocese of the ecclesiastical province in which you live, but that's probably not going to work for you. Hypothetically, you could also go to the Apostolic Nuncio in Washington, D.C. The Apostolic Nuncio is basically the Vatican's ambassador to the United States, and handling interdiocesan disputes is one of the things that he's tasked with. But frankly, that's not likely to work either. So when we come back from the break, I'll tell you what I think you can do that may be more practical to help out.
All right, Anonymous, hang on, and we'll finish up that question right after this.
When it comes to Catholic teachings about Mary, there's one question we hear more than any other. Where is that in the Bible? The answer? Everywhere. In Bible Mary, the Mother of Jesus and the Word of God, Father John Weiss opens Scripture to reveal a Mary who has been hiding in plain sight. Order your copy of Bible Mary today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
As we read the Gospels, every Christian faces the question again and again, what does Jesus mean? Getting the answer right is critical to both growth in holiness and fruitful evangelization. Want to know Jesus better so you can introduce him to your friends? Then it's time to get serious about understanding his words. Why not join Catholic Answers for our 10th annual Apologetics Conference? Learn from me the parables, sermons, and conversations of Jesus Christ. September 26th through 29th, right here in sunny San Diego. Learn from our guests, Dr. Scott Hahn and Kimberly Hahn, Dr. Ray Guarendi, Father Sebastian Walsh, Billy Junker, Father Paul Check, and, of course, all of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. It'll be 4 days of fun, faith, fellowship, and a live radio show. Seats are still available, but going fast, visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 1-888-291-8000 today.
Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, bulk cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or visit whywearecatholic.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy was just in the middle of answering a question from an anonymous caller about being restricted in a couple of dioceses and what would be the next step about approaching to get a resolution. So if two dioceses aren't moving, Jimmy, what would be the next step to find a solution to this?
Okay, so here's a practical reality, and it's not going to be a pleasant one, but it's a reality. The chances of appealing above a bishop's head and getting an instruction from higher up to let a lay person, and it's not just you, it's any lay person, get involved in lay ministry is basically zero. The way the church handles these things is they leave lay ministry up to the discretion of not just the local bishop, but in particular the local pastor. And so if you've already escalated it to the bishop, you really don't have a practical chance of getting a counter judgment from a higher authority. That would be virtually impossible to do. So how do we progress in a positive way with the situation? Well, the first thing you said, one of the dioceses is actually being supportive. They're just moving slowly. Well, you sure don't want to try to appeal over that bishop's head. If he's being supportive but just slow, you know, you want to work with that situation. In terms of the other diocese where you didn't indicate that they're being positive, the way to address the situation there is to go on a charm offensive. And really, you want to go on a charm offensive. If you want to do lay ministry, you want to go on a charm offensive in both places. Now, that can be challenging for someone, you know, who has who has autism, but it's doable. What it requires is the acquisition of skill. And so I'm going to give you a short course on how, just in a couple of minutes, on how you can acquire the skills necessary to function in this environment. I'm going to be brutally honest. Skill number one, do not blame other people for your situation. We all have handicaps that we have to deal with. Now, if you need a friend to talk to and vent privately about your frustrations, that's totally fine. You can identify a friend who you can vent to and take out your frustrations that way, but do not take them out on other people. Because if you, to the extent you do, it's going to push people away that you want to win over. Secondly, if someone tells you you're stepping over a line, immediately apologize humbly. As you know, don't get defensive. Say, "Oh, I'm terribly sorry. I didn't realize. Please forgive me." And get some training in terms, and this involves, you know, some education, some role play, but get some training in terms of how to interact with non-autistic people. And to the extent you can acquire these skills, they'll benefit you not only in this area of your life, but in other areas too. So there are loads of successful autistic people in the world. There are loads of people with other cognitive styles who are, you know, neuroatypical in various ways. I'm neuroatypical too. Autism is not one of my things, but I have more than one neuroatypical aspect. For example, I'm dyslexic, I'm synesthetic, and I'm hyperphantasic. So I understand what it's like to have a different cognitive style than everybody else. But the trick is to learn how to work successfully with the cognitive styles of the people around you. And that means not blaming them. It means, and instead of blaming yourself, because you don't need to blame yourself for what you are, you just need to say, okay, I know what I am. I understand what they are. What I need to do is figure out how can I work with them in a mutually beneficial way. And that's going to mean trying to learn how to pick up on cues and where some that you otherwise might not notice. It's going to mean trying to learn where boundaries are for other people that you might not personally have a boundary there, but it is something that can be done. We're all quirky, all human beings, and we all have to learn to work to live together. So it is an achievable task, and I want to be encouraging to you in that regard.
Anonymous, thank you so much for calling. Hope all goes well with the circumstances you're in. I'll offer up a prayer for you as well, because I know sometimes it can get a little difficult when dealing with things that are above your pay grade, I guess you can say in one way. So thank you for your call. And with that, we move to Thomas in Milwaukee, listening on YouTube. Thomas, welcome to the show, and go right ahead with your question.
Hello, can you hear me?
Loud and clear. Go right ahead.
Yes. Uh-huh.
All right. Thank you, sir. So I am in the middle of studying the writings of the Apostolic Fathers, and I'm on Methetus right now. I don't know how familiar you guys are with it, but I had a question regarding the epistle, which is how the Catholic liturgical calendar, seasons, feast days, holidays, aligns with the epistle of Methetus to Diogenetus. I'm probably butchering the pronunciation.
That's okay. I know who you mean.
Specifically in chapter 4, specifically in chapter 4, when he's talking about the other observances of the Jews, the inference or the implication is that holidays or seasons are not Christian, and it was a bit confusing to me. And yeah, I was wondering how the liturgical calendar is viewed in light of Mathetes.
Okay, well, it's been a while since I reviewed Mathetes's epistle to Diognetus. So I'd have to go back and reread it. I'm afraid I don't have it in front of me. But you mentioned he's specifically commenting on Jewish seasons and holidays. And that's something that is quite true. Christians are not bound by Jewish seasons and holidays. In fact, in the letter to the Colossians, St. Paul tells his audience of Christians, do not let anyone judge you in a feast or a new moon or a Sabbath. And those were the three kinds of Jewish holy days. There were the annual feasts, some of which were seasons because they would go on for like a week. There were the monthly new moons, which had their own special observances. And then there was the weekly Sabbath. And Paul says all of these things pointed forward to Christ, kind of like a shadow is cast by a substance. But now that the substance is here, we're no longer bound by those things. And they were only ever binding on Jewish people. And so they're certainly not binding on anybody today. So so that is kind of at the root of what Mathetes, and we don't really know if Mathetes was his real name. The epistle to Diognetus is sometimes considered anonymous because Mathetes is just the Greek word for student. So Mathetes was a student of the Christian faith, or a disciple of the Christian faith. But that's without reviewing the specific language that's used in the document, that may be all it's saying is Christians don't keep Jewish holidays, and we don't. By the second century, when this letter was written, Christians definitely were keeping some holy days. They were keeping the Lord's Day, Sunday. So that was already part of the Christian liturgical calendar, and other holidays and seasons grew from there as people wanted to commemorate, the resurrection of Jesus at Easter and the birth of Jesus at Christmas and, you know, various preparatory periods for those like Advent and Lent, and the liturgical calendar grew over time. But what Mathetes is going to be talking about is we're not keeping Jewish feasts, and we're not keeping pagan feasts. And in his day, the Christian liturgical calendar was pretty sparse. You know, it hadn't had a chance to develop yet. This is the second century. Now, if I reviewed the language that he uses, and he's just dead set against holidays of any kind, well, then I'd just say he's wrong. You know, there, just because he's in the second century doesn't mean he's correct about everything. And so Christians discerned, under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, that you can have special days on which you celebrate special things. But for Christians, that's not pagan holidays that pagans celebrate, like where they're worshiping the moon god or stuff like that. And it's also not Jewish holidays. We developed our own over the course of time under the guidance of the Holy Spirit.
How's that, Thomas?
Great answer. Thank you very much. I'm sure others have questions. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thanks, Thomas.
No problem.
All right. And with that, let's go to our final break. That way we can have a nice, a longer final segment. And with that, there are a couple of lines open, so we can try to get to your call. You can reach us at 888-318-7884. That's 888-31-TRUTH.
There's only one. Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
At EWTN Radio, your family. And because you're a part of our family, we value your opinions on what you hear on EWTN. You can call our listener comment line 24/7 at 205-795-5773. We value your comments, your questions, and any suggestions you may have to make EWTN Radio even better. 205-795-5773. And thank you for listening to EWTN Radio.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. If you if you're looking for something fun to do in September, you can always join us for the Catholic Answers Conference, where we're going to have a lot of great speakers, including our very own Jimmy Akin and the rest of the Catholic Answers apologists. This year's national conference is Learn From Me, the Parables, Sermons, and Conversations of Jesus Christ. That's September 26th through the 29th here in beautiful San Diego. Our keynote address is going to be by Dr. Scott Hahn, the founder and president of the St. Paul Center. Kimberly Hahn is also going to be there, Father Sebastian Walsh, Dr. Ray Guarendi, and Dr. William Junker. It's going to be a great time. If you can, come hang out. It's going to be a fun time. It always is. And you can register at CatholicAnswersConference.com. That's CatholicAnswersConference.com. Well, Jimmy, I'm still craving a hamburger now after all this conversation, but I'm not a fan of mustard, so maybe some barbecue sauce. Yeah, I used to love it, and then I think at one point it just became too much, and now I'm all about barbecue sauce. So
okay, well, as they say, de gustibus non est disputandum.
That's
there's to be no dispute about tastes.
There we go. Excellent. All right, that sounds like an excellent quote to hang up in my office. Perfect. All right, Jimmy. With that, we go to Rebecca in Wichita, Kansas, listening on YouTube. Rebecca, go right ahead with your question.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I love this show, and I'm so happy I got in. My question is, it seems like there's so much suffering in the world today, and it's just increasing all the time. I'm just curious, has anyone ever said it might be a possibility that our purgatory is here on Earth?
Well, sure. I mean, the purpose of purgatory is to free us from disordered desires so that we're not being tempted in heaven, you know, by sin and stuff like that, so that we can give ourselves unrestrictedly to God and experience His love in its fullness. And so, you know, one of the things about suffering is it can, doesn't always, depends on how you react to it, but if you react in the right way, it can help free you from disordered desires. And so if someone is able to become perfectly pure of disordered desires by the time they die, then they would have experienced their purgatory in this life, and they would not need further purification. They would go directly to heaven. So that is something that gets talked about. Now, having said that, you mentioned that there's suffering in the world today, and that's undoubtedly true. But you also said it's getting worse and worse. And there's actually reason to question that. There is a known cognitive bias that humans have that you hear the expression hindsight is golden. And what that normally means is you have an accurate appraisal of things after they've happened, you know, and once you've learned what their effects are. But there's another kind of hindsight bias that people have where they think the past was better than it was. And this is you could call it a number of things. For example, the good old days fallacy. But everybody has a tendency to think of the past as being better than it was. This is why you hear old people talking about how things were when they were growing up and it was so much better than today. Yeah, but if you go and study the data about how it was when they were growing up, there were more people dying from war and disease and all kinds of things than now. And a few years ago, there was a book that was written by he's actually a linguist and cognitive scientist named Steven Pinker. And he's not a Christian, but he wrote a book called The Better Angels of Our Nature. And what he did in this book was look at various ways of categorizing human flourishing, like chance of dying a violent death. And he looked at the chance of dying a violent death on the scale of millennia, and then centuries, and then decades. And instead of it getting worse and worse, it got better and better. Your chance of dying a violent death thousands of years ago was much higher than it is today. And the way we know that is we've dug up bones of people from thousands of years ago, and we can tell these people died violent deaths. You know, they've got sword marks on their bones and spear marks and things like that. And then in the period where we have historical records, which is going back hundreds of years, we know about the wars. And again, archaeology has uncovered people's bones. And then if you look at your chance of dying a violent death in, say, the 20th century, where we have good societal statistics, it goes down even further. And so there are ups and downs in this pattern, but the fundamental pattern is your chance of having a violent death has been going way, way, way down. Same thing is true of dying of illness. And in the past, people died at much younger ages because, now, many of them were infants, but nevertheless, people were dying at much younger ages from all kinds of different disease. And then you got kind of a bump if you were able to survive until age 5, and then you could survive for a number of decades, but still people were dying in, you know, their 50s, 60s, 70s, and people are living a bit longer than that now. So the human lifespan has been increasing, not only because violent deaths have been going down, but also because the chance of illness has been going down. Also, if you go back just a couple hundred years, the vast majority of people in the world lived in abject poverty. Even poor people today live better than kings did in the ancient world. I mean, kings didn't have smartphones, they didn't have microwaves, they didn't have air conditioning, they didn't have televisions, they didn't have the internet, they didn't have any of the modern conveniences that we have. And so so actually, in a lot of ways, even though there are problems in the world, and things could be better than they are, and hopefully will be better than they are in the future, it's simply a myth of the media that the world is just getting worse and worse and worse. The reason that media sources play that angle is because humans are alert to danger. And so if the media can present us with the idea that there are dangers out there, that will get eyeballs on the screen. That's why there's that old saying, if it bleeds, it leads. So I'm not denying that there are problems in the world, far from it. And in some areas, the problems are getting worse. But in terms of a global average, actually things have been getting better. And so we want to bear that in mind as we think about these issues.
All right, Rebecca, thank you so much for your call. I want to get as many people as on the air with Jimmy as I can. So with that, we move on to Michelle in Indianapolis, Indiana, listening on EWTN. Michelle, go right ahead with your question.
Thank you. I love your show. It's kind of a weird question, but Jimmy, I was just wondering, is it okay, I guess I was going to say as Catholics, but in general, to use like herbal supplements, like adaptogens, like things that are supposed to help
okay.
the mood.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything against it?
There's no teaching that you can't take herbs. For various purposes, mood improvement is one of them. Now, we got to be a little careful about what type of mood improvement we're talking about. If we're talking about getting high and losing your moral faculties, well, yeah, there's a problem with that. But if you're just talking about mild mood elevation to, let's say you've been suffering from, you know, a depression or something like that, and you feel better when you take a particular, you mentioned adaptogens, and those are substances that are meant to help people deal with stress. So if you're taking something to help you deal with stress, you know, like ginseng is one of the adaptogens that's out there. There's nothing wrong with that. You're not getting high. You're not losing your moral faculties. You're just feeling better. And so the herbal supplement would be assuming it has a therapeutic effect on you. All it's doing is having a therapeutic effect, and that's okay. There's a passage in the book of Sirach where it talks about how doctors, you know, perform a function for God. These are not the modern accredited doctors, but doctors perform a function for God. They make preparations out of natural substances and they help people out. Well, so all you're doing is in this situation, you would be trying out different natural substances and seeing if they help you. And as long as they're not causing a problem, like poisoning your liver because you're doing way too much of them, or getting you high and causing you to lose your moral faculties, well, then there's not a problem using them.
All right, Michelle, thank you for your call. We now move on to Nicholas in Missouri, listening on YouTube. Nicholas, go right ahead.
Hey, Jimmy. I have a request for information. I'm trying to find something to read or study on typology of St. Peter in the Old Testament, specifically on Joseph and Moses. I've heard of Eliakim's typology in Joshua's, but I was specifically looking at Joseph and Moses.
Well, I don't know that I can help you, because Moses was the leader of God's people, and he's more naturally typologically connected to Christ. In fact, Matthew, in particular, compares Jesus to Moses. You know, and it's not just Matthew, mm-hmm. but Matthew has him given the Sermon on the Mount, which corresponds to how Moses went up Mount Sinai and returned with the Ten Commandments for the people. And so he presents Jesus. In fact, in the beginning of Matthew's Gospel, Jesus recapitulates several different things from the life of Moses. Like, as a baby, the governing authorities tried to kill Moses, but he escaped. And in the same way, the governing authorities tried to kill Jesus, but he escaped. So you also have the prophecy from Deuteronomy 18 about God will send you a prophet like me, like Moses. And you'll find various references in the Gospels saying, "We have found the prophet," meaning the prophet like Moses. So Moses is more naturally typologically aligned with Jesus. If I was going to try to typologically align someone connected with Moses to Peter, it would be Joshua, who was Moses's successor. Once Moses dies and goes to heaven, Joshua becomes his successor. Once Jesus dies and rises and goes to heaven, Peter becomes his successor as head of the church. It's not obvious to me that Joseph, the patriarch, would be typologically connected with St. Peter. I'm sure you could find various parallels to him, but one of the things that I'd kind of caution you about is typology can be interesting to think about, but it shouldn't be used to prove doctrine, because it doesn't. In fact, when it comes to the Eliakim situation that you sometimes hear described as typology, that Eliakim, for people who may not be aware, is a figure in the book of Isaiah. And he does parallel Peter, but I don't think that's typology. I think Jesus, when he commissions Peter, is making a direct allusion back to Eliakim. So I don't think that's just typology that Christians have discovered. I think Jesus is making a direct parallel consciously. He's saying, "You are to me, Peter, what Eliakim was to the house of David." I actually wouldn't classify that as typology. But we want to be careful with typology. What you can do is just make lists of characteristics of different people. So you could take Joseph and list everything you can think of about Joseph, and Peter and list everything you can think of about Peter. And where they match, you could say, well, there's some symbolism there, but that doesn't mean I should make much out of it, because typology fundamentally should not be used to try to prove a doctrine, if that's what you have in mind. It's interesting to think about, but it won't convince a person who doesn't already share your view. So thus, St. Thomas Aquinas says in his works that doctrine is to be proved by the literal sense of the text, not by the spiritual sense of the text, which is what typology belongs to. And I see a lot of Catholic apologists making a mistake when they try to appeal to typology to convince the unconvinced.
Nicholas, thank you so much for your call. We appreciate it as you hear the music, because the hour is over. Jimmy, thank you so much for joining me. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Yeah,
look forward to next time.
So do I, Jimmy. So do I. It's always a blast being on the air with you, and not just screening the calls for you. So every once in a while, yeah. It's nice.
Gracias y muy bien.
Gracias, Jimmy. Que tengas un buen fin de semana.
I caught part of that.
Have a great weekend, Jimmy.
You too.
That'll do it for us here at Catholic Answers Live.